The Lose Control Podcast, a paradox to peaceful, positive living that contains raw honesty and uncensored emotions. Matty I here. Thank you for listening to the Lose Control Podcast. We will hear inspiring stories from darkness to redemption that embrace the journey of living life on life's terms, leading to the discovery of your purpose.
Well, welcome again, everybody. Over 1,000 listeners, 11 countries. Thank you so much, everybody, for being a part of this tribe. It takes everybody to have this movement work, and I believe that's what's happening. Thank you so much for being a part of the Lose Control Podcast. Another fantastic interview tonight. His name is Norm. He has oodles of sobriety, lots of wisdom, lots of experience. Man, I hoped I could interview when I started to put this endeavor together. Wasn't sure if he'd say yes, but he did.
Excellent guest tonight, Norm, a gentleman I met about 20 years ago at one of my runs in the program, and have thought highly of this gentleman. He's a reserved man, but when he speaks, it's nice to listen to, no doubt. I thought about him when we started this endeavor to do the podcast. I did, in fact, think of Norm in hopes that maybe, you know, give us the time to come out here. And sure enough, when I asked him last week, he was more than happy to. So, here's Norm. What's going on, sir?
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks for inviting me over.
Right on. You have 85 is your sobriety date, so you've got tons of experience. I know you were upstate New York. We'll just kind of start there and we'll just roll with this, how your journey started.
Okay. I was born in upstate New York, just outside of Rochester, and had a great childhood. When I was putting this thing together a little bit in my mind, layers of the onion, you know how that goes. I thought of three things that kind of made me who I am in many ways. My first recollection is not wanting to go to kindergarten. And we lived really close to school, and I remember not wanting to go, and my mother walking me across the field to the kindergarten. She's saying, okay, I got to go. And me screaming bloody murder, crying. I did not want to go in there. Even though there were 20 other kids in there who were laughing and playing and everything else, I was just like, man, I just did not want to go. I remember that. I don't know. I'm 5 years old. I don't recollect.
Because I too grew up.
Anything that triggered I'm going to be abandoned, or, you know, the security issue. I think for me, and I developed certain traits, but I believe everybody was born with a little insecurity issue.
I can identify with that 100%.
That's what I believe. Anyways, that's my first recollection of something like that. The second one, I ended up, they tried to raise me Catholic.
You know? Me too.
not so much with my parents, my father and mother, but godmother was really, she was a diehard Catholic, and mass every day, the whole nine yards. And of course, you know, I went to the local Catholic school and stuff like that, and that didn't take. I remember one day my mother wanting me to wear shorts. You know, she had this cute little, I think it was like a little sailor outfit. Oh, my goodness gracious. I was humiliated, and all the kids made fun of me. And ever since then, looking back, and I suppose I could go to therapy for it, but and they would have a blast with me. But my relationship with my mother wasn't ever the same after that.
Really?
It was very standoffish. And shortly after that, I was helping my father, and I really looked up to my father, and he asked me for a tool, and I didn't know what it was, and I handed him the wrong tool, and, you know, he said something like, man, you really are strange, or you're odd, or something like that, which, you know, didn't do my self-esteem any good. So those three things, between the kindergarten, the having to wear shorts, and my father cutting me like that, I think had a lot to do with the fact that emotionally, I think I'm pretty cold. I've never cried over my parents passing away or good friends passing away or anything like that. Now I do get attached to cats. I've had cats and I've shed a tear or two over a cat dying, but when it comes to people and stuff like that, I'm very standoffish emotionally. I suppose I could go and if I wanted to look into that more, but I don't really see the need for it. Right on. I'm okay with it. You know, I've done some work. I know my parents did the best they knew how. Here, let me tell you another story. I never met my grandparents, even though one of them lived in the same town as me all my life. They never said that she was living there or anything like that. So I don't know what went on there. I know my mother said that she watched her father go to work one day when she was 12 and she never saw him again. He never came home. And shortly after that, her mother abandoned her. So she went to live with, you know, her aunt, which was my godmother. And so, you know, I never recall my parents ever saying that they loved me. I don't recall that. And I think my brothers have said the same thing. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. And I know that. And yeah, you mean, yeah, therapy probably would be interesting.
Well, I'm energy, good. There was a peaceful energy about you. And it wasn't some people that are quiet and reserved or standoffish and unapproachable. And you were never not, you were never, you know, not approachable. You just always had a peace about you.
Oh, you know? Should see me my first 6 months in AA, though.
Again, you know, you have a couple of years under your belt, so you probably had to work on that craft for a minute or two to find that peace. But yeah, so it sounded like you didn't grow up with a lot of love and affection, so maybe it tailed off that way. So I would see it tough getting sober and not being able to get in touch with your emotions or feelings, but that's coming from a person that's, I'm not an intellect over emotion guy. So you know, when I was able to get into myself and start discovering who Matthew is, why he does what he does and really tick, you know, it comes out to my emotions and feelings and I am able to place them and compartmentalize them on why I react a certain way. It may not be about the moment. It might've been something, you know, prior to, I would see that as a difficult run for, you know, because just sobriety is, you're like I said, you're a peaceful person. So,
you know, what's true, and I need to always remember this, try to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes, even, you know, that saying, you know, you never know what somebody's been through or going through at the moment. Always try to give somebody a little bit of grace, you know, and understanding. Sometimes it's difficult.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times, shoot the name. Shoot from the hip.
You had a, I read in the, you know, your bio that you love working with horses. Did that love for horses come in upstate New York, or was that at a later time in your life?
No, that was a later time in life. After I came back, I was always a good runner.
Oh, I noticed that too. I absolutely love running. Do you run still today?
Yeah. That's another story. It's tweaked one my right glute last night. I was supposed to run a race today.
How were you?
And I got up, I went down there, and as I started to warm up, it just kept getting worse and worse, and I couldn't run. And it's been very, since then, it's been really difficult for me to walk.
Being sober the last few years, running has really been a just a huge tool for me. It's just over, you know, being able to, you know, it's not the run, it's the accomplishing the goal.
Yeah.
And then with all the thought processes I go through while I'm, you know, from controlling my breathing to not getting anxious to overcoming any pains or tweaks or whatever it might be. And a lot of times just lose myself into just thinking about whatever. So it's very therapeutic for me. But.
Yeah, I learned early on. It's so, you know, I didn't have to depend on it. Here we go again. You know, I didn't have to depend on anybody or anything else. I was, you know, I was in charge of, you know, how I ran. If I ran really well, you know, I'm the one who did it, nobody else. You know, just self-sufficiency, right? But I came back from overseas and started running again and eventually got on an Army sports team, and it was called Modern Pentathlon, 5 events. And one of the events was horseback riding. Horseback riding, fencing, shooting, swimming, and running.
Oh, how cool is that?
Yeah. And so after I got out of the military, I just got a job with the horses. And, you know, one thing led to another and ended up, you know, with racehorses. And it's just one of those things.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was cool. Except back in the 70s when I started that, it was, I don't think it is today, but back then it was accepted that if you were, I don't want to say a drunk, but if you drank heavily or drank at all in the horse business, it was okay. And so, you know, that was, I could get a job and I can drink all the
time. Right on. You know? You said the military, what was, can you talk about that at all? Did you go in after high school or at a time?
Yeah, that actually, you won't hear this. You don't hear this very often anymore. I didn't pick up my first drink until I graduated from high school. And I started going off the rails really quickly. And my father at the time was having some issues with his business, and he didn't want to carry any dead weight. And so he told me either to start paying rent or get out. And so I got out, joined the Army.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. You don't hear that very often anymore. Start paying rent or get out. Right?
Yeah.
Well, you hurt my feelings. So I got out.
When I dropped out of high school, my dad said, he did tell me that. Same thing when I dropped out of high school, as a matter of fact. Your dad said, but that dad would remind me of the great Santini, you know, my dad, you know, yeah. As it was. But it was either go to work or, you know, you can't stay here. You know,
yeah. Go to work, yeah. You don't pay rent. Yeah. So it doesn't have anything to do with AA, but I see some of the stuff that goes on today. I just shake my head.
Right.
Yeah. Anyways.
So got out of the military. Mm-hmm. Came back. Where'd you go when you came back? Because you're from upstate New York. So where did you go? You came back to?
Well, I ended up in Virginia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And worked in Virginia for 4 or 5 years. And the reason I stayed in Virginia was I met a young gal there. She was too young. And we split up. And I didn't look at another woman for 5 years.
Ooh.
I was drinking, though.
I was trying to drown the feelings. I got you. Because you just said that they, you know, they just got out of high school and started drinking and started to take off. Is that, it was like an immediate...
Well, it was a little more than 6 months. It was just a little more than 6 months, actually, from the time I had my first drink to the time I was in Vietnam and I got court-martialed. Yeah, I was in a unit. It was kind of a special unit. And anyways, I got introduced to marijuana over there, pot, and it was really strong and I really liked it.
But that was the lesser of most evils over there, I guess, from what people got a lot of... military got hooked on from opium and heroin.
I saw guys shooting up heroin, getting ready to come home the next day. Hmm. They're in an area where everybody processes out, and a couple of thousand guys probably in this hold. It's like a holding pen, really. Hmm. 6 months after my first drink, I'm getting busted for smoking dope over there, and I got court-martialed. And long story, but I got really lucky. My whole life is one of being really lucky. I got set up.
Okay.
And so I got acquitted on being set up. But here's the thinking. The thinking is already established within me. I left the courtroom and went out and got high.
Yeah.
Without any thought that, you know, what happens if I get busted again? They're going to, because they wanted to put me in the Long Bend stockade for a year. Make an example out of me. And I didn't even think about it. I just, all I wanted to do was get high. You know, the thinking was already established. So that's really important. For me, it's important that I remember that.
Yeah.
That when it comes to getting loaded, I don't think. I mean, when an obsession is taking hold of me, I don't think of any consequences or anything. The big book is true. You know, can't bring up with a sufficient memory what took place the night before, the week before, whatever. I just go ahead and go straight for it.
Just no thought about anything but myself and what I had in my target.
Just want to get the next drink or drug. Doesn't matter.
So you came here in Virginia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you make it out of the court martial, back over here, but you're still drinking.
Oh, yeah,
working
yeah,
with
yeah.
the horses.
I'm working on my craft.
There you go. Tell me about the craft, where we're at.
Well, it's
what is this? The
mid '80s.
Mid '80s.
You know, late '80s. I'm just, you know, I'm working the horses. I'm really confident. I just got a little. I don't know if it's bored or anything like that. One thing about the horses is, especially on the racetrack, is it's very transient, and you can get a job almost anywhere. So I just I was one that I'd work a couple of months or 6 months or a year, and then I'd quit, and you know, I'd go out play for a couple of months, 3 months, or whatever.
Perfect lifestyle for an active alcoholic.
Until the money started to run off, and then I'd just get a job and maintain and quit and go someplace and play and drink, and that was my lifestyle for a long time. I didn't take care of myself. I lived in run down, you know, just places where, you know, there were a lot of insects, bugs, and
yeah,
you know, all I wanted was enough money to keep drinking, you know, the way I wanted to drink. This was really important to me. I was some really, really wonderful women in my life. And I was in a relationship and she was wonderful. I don't even know how this happened. I don't, maybe she was in a moment of weakness or something. I don't know. But my drinking was ruining it, had ruined it. And I was just more or less just hanging out. But I remember one day sitting in the back steps thinking things are just terrible. And this is what life is like. It's just not worth living. Of course, then I kind of shook my head and went to the refrigerator and got my next beer and moved on from that. But that thinking is just, whoa.
Yeah. I mean, that thinking
was... That's the first thought that I really had that, looking back, going, man, oh, man. So that relationship ended and got another job. And I was at this job and a good outfit, really top-notch outfit that I was working for. And we were on the racetracks and we were going from place to place, and
what were you doing with the
galloping? I was breaking horses and galloping, yeah.
Oh,
exercising.
Cool.
Yeah. And we were at Churchill Downs, and
what was it to take to go to the next level to be a jockey? Was that ever a thought process?
I was too heavy. Although I did ride a few steeplechase races.
Okay.
Yeah. I was drinking pretty heavy. You know, one of the saving graces I think that helped me get through everything was I never stopped running.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
I mean, I remember plenty of times that in the summertime I'd finish up a run and I'd be, you know, in the shower drinking a beer. But that was one of the saving graces, and being young, under, you know, in 30, you know, under 35, you know, it's between the exercise and galloping and,
yeah,
you know, healthy lifestyle like that physically, you know, I could do that. And I would run and I could train, and, you know, I was a pretty good runner. I've got some talent for it. Kentucky Derby Day. Man, we finished up early. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. We finished up, and you never want to see the Derby. You never want to leave the grounds, because once you leave the grounds, you can't hardly get back
in. Imagine.
You know, it's just a madhouse. So I was there and I was drinking all day long, not eating. And I was so drunk by 6 o'clock when the Derby went off. And I just embarrassed myself in front of my boss.
Oh,
gosh. You know, that was on Saturday. That Tuesday, I think I jumped in a race and ran really well. I mean, it's amazing what my human body could withstand. And, after that race, I remember having two or three beers and going home. Next morning, I had a cold, and that was always the way. It seemed like the more I ran, the more I drank. It was like a vicious circle. Mm. And I'd start to get really fit, and then my body would break down. And it was just so, you know, it always depressed me when that would happen. And then I'd have to go through that sick period of 2 weeks or whatever it was, and then kind of come back and, you know, and of course I'd still be drinking and all that. So anyways, I was so disgusted with myself. I said, I'm going to quit once again. You know, I've had it, you know, it's the same old thing, you know, time and time again, you know, nothing's changed. Being on the racetrack, it's like its own community,
yeah,
a little community. I could see guys who were 20 years younger than me coming onto the racetrack, and they were just like me, full of piss and vinegar and just, you know, just really full of themselves, you know. And then I could see guys like me, and then I could see guys 20, 30 years in the future and the life that they lived on the track, drunks.
Yeah.
And I knew I was headed to that. And that scared the heck out of me because I didn't want to be in that area. You know, I didn't want to go there. So I quit my job and I went out to my brother's. My brother lived in Colorado, and he and his wife, they're Christians, but they went to church and they had a really good, they had a couple of kids. He was building this house. They lived at 9,200 feet. They lived up in the mountains, away from everybody. So I went out there and lived with him for 3 months.
That's when you said it's like a rehab.
It's like a rehab, what I call an incubator.
Yeah. You know?
Really?
Yeah.
That's what they are. You get there, you're sick, you get there, it's nice and warm, you're taken care of, you know, you get healthy again. So I got my running going again, really healthy. And
that's tough running at 9,200.
Yeah, right? But it was wonderful. They had a great state park only 2 miles from where they lived. Wow. And I could run out in the woods. Yeah. And I mean, just, oh man, it was fantastic.
I get the trails. Goosebumps. I know exactly
it was just
feeling.
Wonderful. Just wonderful. And it was up in the mountains outside of Golden, Colorado. You know, I'm living with them and of course their lifestyle and everything like that. And, you know, I'm thinking about a relationship with God again, you know, because I'm empty. I got nothing going on, you know, and somehow that's always percolated with me, you know. Because the Catholic thing didn't take. That didn't take. Nothing wrong with being Catholic or anything. But for me, it just didn't take. It's time to work again. And, you know, I'm just full of fear about everything and all that. And I'm out in Colorado. I could have just gone out and say, okay, let me see what kind of job I wanted. Whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And, but no, I'm going to go back to the horses because that's what I know. You know, I know I can get a job. I know who I can work for. And so I went back and actually went back to Camden, ran into a buddy of mine, old drinking buddy of mine. He said he was getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, what's that?
What year was this?
85.
This is 85.
This is 85.
This is 85.
I said, I didn't know what AA was. Funny thing about it, in another 2 days, I was going to go to my first AA meeting because I went back to the horses, but I was so angry and resentful about the way my life came up. I mean, I've got all the isms going on, yeah, right? Yeah. But I'm not drinking. I'm on a dry drunk. I'm resentful and angry and I hate everybody. And so I got fired from a job. I never got fired from a job. Yeah, I got fired and man, I didn't know what to do. I had bills to pay and, you know, place to live. I got paid rent. I didn't know what to do. I'm at wit's end, right? And I ran into my buddy's girlfriend. We got to talking and within 5 minutes, we got to talking about drinking. You know, I said, I don't drink. I don't want to drink, stuff like that. But she said, hey, you know, I got something that you might want to take a look at. So she handed me a copy of the big book and said, why don't you try reading this? So I did. And I got to the point, I could reading the book, I was going, I'm reading Bill's story. And I was thinking to myself, man, this guy's a real drunk. All the stuff that he's going through, right? I worked in a barn and Bill was a stockbroker on Wall Street.
Right.
We didn't have anything in common until, you know, years later when I'm reading this, I'm going, look at all the times Bill tried to quit drinking and always went back to it. And that was me. I tried to quit drinking probably 10 times from the very first time I tried to quit, which was in 75. You know, I said, man, I'm going down the wrong road here. Yeah, I wanted to quit, but you know.
Yeah.
You know how that goes. Yeah, I was reading Bill's story and I couldn't relate. But right after Bill's story, I was reading and talked about the guy pounding on the bar saying, how'd he get like that? And that was me. Because I just go to my favorite watering hole and just want to say, you know, have a couple and say hi to the guys. And I'd be there 5 or 6 hours later, drunk again. So I went to my first meeting of AA that night. The rest is history, because I really liked it. Really liked AA. And I don't think back then, I don't think they did first step meetings. I don't recall them saying things that really kind of put me on the spot.
So going to your first meeting, I would think that they just have to open up. You know, we talked about not having a lot of feeling or emotion, just as Norm is as a person. But so that had to grab you something there, the love and the affection. And
I was really tired of being alone.
There we go.
You know, really tired of being alone. And, you know, for that hour, you know, I wasn't alone. In AA meetings, we get to talk about two things. At least I do. I get to talk about two things that I dearly love. One is alcohol and the other is me.
Right on.
Right?
That's
so
true.
And so, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the message that I heard that very first night. See, when I quit drinking, I thought my life would get better, and it just kept getting worse. So when I came to AA and they said that this was a threefold disease, that I had to take care of more than just the physical part of it, putting a plug in the jug, I said, so that's what's wrong with me. You know, there's two other areas that I've got to take care of. You know, I've got to find a relationship with God, which I want to, just didn't know how to renew that, you know, get that relationship going. And the second thing is, you know, you guys telling me about, you know, character defects. Mm. You know, and I think, well, I don't have that many. I'm not that bad a guy. You know, I mean, it's so, but more would be revealed along the line. So cookies and coffee at an AA meeting is so important. I mean, it really is, you know, and for me coming into that, coming into that meeting, I could always sit down because I got a sweet tooth to begin with. So if I could come down and have a couple of cookies, good cookies, you know, where I got sober, they always had a good array of stuff, you know, a good cup of coffee and stuff. You know, that was really important. You know, I could feel at home, feel comfortable. But it was a while before I felt let anybody else in because I didn't know how to talk to somebody, you know, look them in the eye and tell them this is how I feel. It took me a long time to connect to that. You know, so I'm in Camden for my first 6 months or first four months of AA. And then, you know, just how it is.
Did you stop? You were AA, but you still doing horses?
Yeah, still doing. Still doing horses. And anyways, my old girlfriend, so she got me a job up in New Hampshire. And that's a big part of my sobriety, New Hampshire. That's because that's where I met my first sponsor, Ray.
Yeah.
And Ray was, you know what a Southie is? Ray Murphy. He got his start when he was 15, getting rid of bodies for the mob.
Right.
It's $500 a pop. So this would have been in the 30s.
Oh.
And it went from there. He had such a story. I mean, I could tell you things that you would just, you know, he wasn't a nice guy.
Stuff you see on TV.
Yeah, he wasn't a nice guy, but he ended up getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he absolutely loved AA and would do anything. If he knew you wanted to get sober, he would do anything for you. He'd go to any lengths to help you. But also he had that edge to him that said, and this was his favorite saying, if you don't want to do it AA's way, suffer. And he meant it.
Right.
And, you know, he'd let you go. You know, I was like a little puppy dog. I stuck around Ray. I'd work up in New Hampshire for 6 months at the track and then come back to Camden for the winter and then go back up there. So that happened for the next 3 years, back and forth and stuff like that. But always Ray was a huge part. But Ray was such a, I became like a little mini Ray. And, little tough guy, and I could hit you over the head with a big book. I'm not proud of that today, but you know, they say sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. I suppose I was about 25 years sober, and I was out in Denver because my brother was still out there, so I would go visit him from time to time. You know, and by that time I had picked up fly fishing, and I was going out there all the time fishing in Colorado. One day I was at a meeting, and across the table from me was this gentleman, and I was like looking in a mirror. I saw myself and I didn't like what I saw. This guy was crass.
He had some time under his belt there.
Yeah, he had some time under his belt. He was crass. He just the whole nine yards. And I said, and I stopped in the meeting. I just stopped and prayed. I said, God, please help me become more compassionate and kind and loving to people. I don't want to be like this anymore. Later on, people would tell me, yeah, I remember you when I first came in and I was scared of you. That's awful.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Yeah, it's awful because I was such a, I don't like the cuss or anything. I was such a hard ass. I was like Ray, you know. And Ray sufficed. Ray was good. He loved people, believe me, you know. But I didn't like what I was becoming. And in AA, I knew there was more. I never hugged anybody, you know. I never smiled at everybody. And so, you know, I learned at age 20, in 25 years in the program with, you know, it's like wooden ships. If you smile at somebody, usually they'll smile back. It's a language we all know, right?
Yeah.
And so I started hugging people, and they were taken back. When they would meet me at a meeting and I'd walk up to them and give them a hug, they were
surprised. The power of the hug is...
It's unbelievable.
That Thursday night at the detox when I go up there and I give each one of them a hug that's left when I leave. And if there's four of them, at least three of them get a tears in their eyes, you know, from the hug. You know, it's just, you know, I mean, you could see the pain in their eyes because I definitely know because I've been there. But just the power of that hug, man, is it's something, man.
Yeah,
it really is.
And my life changed with that. Just doing those simple things, giving hugs, smiling, stop hitting people over the head with a big book. You know, I can't quote the big book anymore. I don't, you know, my life changed. I've got so many more friends in AA. It's just amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and how could you be that long in sobriety? Because in my mind, I had whatever I thought sobriety, long-term sobriety was, forgetting that we were all human beings.
Yeah.
And there's constant adjustments. Even people that aren't alcoholics or drug addicts, they still have to adjust as they travel through life to maintain success in relations, whatever that relation is, you know. But for some reason, in my mind, it would be like, well, if you're sober for 20 years, then you must be, you know, kind, loving and accepting and, you know, all the, you know, you must be identify as exactly all 12 principles. That's who you must be. But that's not the way it is, Maddie.
You know, I'll say this, I wasn't all that bad. Well, I don't know about that, but I mean,
I know what you're talking about.
I've loved being sober. And
yeah,
I mean, I did a lot of things in that period, that time frame that, you know, I did a lot of service work and stuff like that. I just quit being, the hard line stopped. I've become more flexible today. So,
but there still is, you know, a certain, to get sober, to real sobriety, not drinking. There's still A, B, C, D have to do. That's not like some of D, you know.
So definitely.
You know, that's how I share with, you know, as you have a few sponsees, and how I share with them is, one in particular, I try not to beat them up about, hey, did you get into the big book yet? You know, but I say it pretty regularly are you praying in the morning? Tell me something new that you're doing in the morning. So, but I know that if he doesn't do X, Y, Z, it's not going to work, you know, but I can't, you know, so.
Just got to leave it in God's hands.
Yes, you know. But I mean,
we do the work, you know, we're responsible. We need to be there. But, you know, you can't force feed.
No, it doesn't work like that. You just don't want him to go through, you know, what I went through, or, you know, decades, you know, it would be, as a matter of fact, I would have 36 years sobriety if the first time I went to an AA meeting.
I tell you what.
I mean, I don't look back on that and say, I wish, because it is what it is, and I am who I am because of, you know, but, you know.
Wow, I don't know how you did it, man. In and out.
Yeah, and it wasn't like a 30-day chip, six, you know, kept chip.
Really?
It was a 5-year run from 15 to 20. 6 years off, 4 years, 7 years off, 5 years, you know, so, you know, coming back, as you know better than I do, people that add some time up, it's difficult for them to get back because of the shame and whatever and the crash and burn after more relationships, whether it's children or businesses and houses and cars and all that stuff. But then you've also moved along, and then you, all of that just gets taken away and you crash down. And that was always tough. But I always came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew since when I was 15 and I went to my first rehab and I went to Desert Storm sober. You know, Scud missiles flying around on that ocean burning type of stuff. And then I got into drinking again, you know, but I always came back because I remember when I got sober, when I came back from rehab when I was 15 and I came back and I jumped right into the program in 88. And I just remember feeling as I found peace in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every decade that I got sober, I would come back to them because I knew that this was the place to find peace. That was, you know, that's a God thing on how I even made it back as many times as I did. But I always knew that this was a place to find peace and, you know, and you wouldn't be alone, you know, and that was one of the beautiful things about this program is what I've discovered. And now I'm able to, you know, be a part of sharing with other people, you know, and that was one of the things that really spurred this podcast was knowing that, you know, there's so many people out there that can share, like yourself, you know, the story of, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. Let's look at today. What's probably one of the greatest gifts you have right now? Your peace and fishing? Your harmony? I know you're pretty disciplined and regimented.
I am. I'm very.
That has been key.
Very. But very, 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 very rarely do I ever miss a morning reading. I get up and do my readings. I still get up 5 o'clock in the morning, 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, sit down and do. I've got a bunch of stuff that I read, a lot of different devotionals. Some are AA, some are about sobriety. A lot of them are about my faith, my Christian faith. So because I find that's something I'm still, it hasn't been cut, my Christian faith hasn't been cut and dry for me. It's more of what we call in AA, the educational variety, but it's changing. I see it changing. So that's, I keep trying. I just keep doing step 11, which says to keep seeking. So I keep trying to seek a better relationship, you know, better conscious contact with the God of my understanding. That understanding keeps changing a little bit, and I'm really happy the direction it's going in. But I very rarely do I miss any readings. It doesn't matter where I go or what I'm doing, you know. I've always got my books. If in September I went to Mexico for 10 days, or, you know, I just take my phone and do photos of those days that I'm there, right? So I don't miss it. I don't have the room to carry all those books, you know.
Right.
Just, you know. But on my phone, I've still got them.
Oh, they're you know, super important to my.
So, yes. You know, that's what's really important to me, that I keep seeking in that arena. Very rarely do I miss a meeting, you know, during the course of a day.
Right.
And, you know, what's really, really interesting is I feel that Alcoholics Anonymous has evolved more in the past 4 or 5 years than any other time, except for the very beginning of AA. I used to cut corners, you know, like when I was in with the horses, you cut corners because, you know, the next beer is calling. Some of the other stuff. Yeah. I get asked to do things like this. A couple of weeks ago, I was asked to go up to the state convention and say a couple of words to some people, which was really nice. It's been a real, my sobriety has been a real blessing for me and hopefully for other people. But, you know, a lot of things have changed, you know, things that we don't even think about really, or most people wouldn't change, but I mentioned it earlier. Started taking a shower on a daily basis and brushing my teeth and washing my clothes, or keep a really clean place. I'm not fanatical about it, but when you walk into where I live, everything's got its place, and, you know, I mean, it's not not walking into a, you know,
right,
a rat hole like I used to live.
Yes.
You know, because I used to live at a,
Dad always said growing up, Greg Santini said, Matthew, your bedroom, condition of your bedroom is reflective of your life. And lo and behold, how strong that statement is as I've traveled this journey here. Yeah. I mean, it's just so much bigger, that statement about, you know, the inside of my mind, if it's all jumbled and cluttered, my life is jumbled and cluttered. And with the meditation and the morning stuff and the running and exercising, which has, you know, that I took that under my wing, and just always filling my mind with improving and how listening to other people's stories.
I was bringing my motorcycle back from Denver, and that's all I listened to, AA stories all the way back, just in there. Just have a, you know, three days of nothing but AA stories. It was so cool.
Yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. So I, you know, try to eat fairly healthy today.
I would say that's my biggest, is the sweet tooth is my biggest, as if it was with drinking and drugging. And it's just, I notice though, when I'm tired or my knees hurt a lot or whatever, find myself more susceptible to not eating healthy. And then, you know, I'm eating at 12 at night and, you know, not, you know, I wake up after sleeping for 2 hours and I wake up like I haven't eaten in days, and I battle that. That's my biggest battle right now, is overcoming that. And, you know, it doesn't seem like a big deal, but it is, you know, for me, because I mean, it just takes my whole next day. I'm groggy, you know, when I start out in the morning. And if I don't get a chance to get to the gym by 6 a.m., do my 2 hours before I start my day, after I'm already up, you know, I won't get up. I'll miss my reading. I'll miss my, you know, if I eat at night, you know, because it's, you know, so it throws my, because I have to be disciplined. When you sent me your bio, when I read that, I said, I can see that. But what I can see most importantly is, like, in myself, is discipline has been my, probably one of my, I don't know, but I'm going to say one of my greatest assets that I've instilled in my, put into my life, that in, you know, in sobriety. You know, the last 3 years of my life is I am, you know, I have, you know, click clack, you know, and it's just, I try not to get beat myself up if I miss, but I know I need to have a certain schedule. I have to do certain things.
Yeah, I've got a schedule. I very rarely do I ever go off it. It's really important. You know, one thing about Alcoholics Anonymous or getting sober, you're responsible for your own sobriety.
Yes, sir.
Although one of my gift, I guess you could say, I've always kind of kept in contact with guys who've gone out, and at least they know there's one person in the room that's not judging them. You stick around long enough, you know, you're going to just step over the dead bodies.
Yes,
you know, and that's what's sad, because this is untreated alcoholism's terminal. I don't know if these guys think that can't happen to them or what. Man, I thought he was going to get it, Brian. Man, he was a nice guy. I'd known him for quite a while. Came in, he was doing all the right things. Looked like he was going to get it. Tried it one more time.
That was it.
That was it. Not this past February, but a year of February. He got kicked out. He was in a halfway house. Of course, you know, as soon as they found out he was high, they said, you got to go. They found him the next morning in the back of the yard. Of course, he'd gotten down to about 30 degrees. And he just froze to death.
That was one cat I had up at the house up there at Asheville Pavilion. And he was from Irmo, so we bonded. And he was younger. Great, great spirit. You know, he was a great musician. We had to let him go out of the house because we had found out that when we went food shopping at Ingles, he was hitting up the stock boy for some shit. Anyway, so then we found out we had to confront him in the house. And, you know, said, man, John, you got to go, man. You know, they had to send him home. He went back to Irmo, and I got out 2 weeks later, and I wasn't home a fucking week. And I got news that he had overdosed, and he found him in the shitty ass hotels. Life or death, man.
Getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous has really afforded me a good life. No longer angry or resentful.
There you go. I can say that myself. I was just very, very angry.
And I couldn't figure out what was wrong. I quit drinking. Why does my life suck?
You know, I guess I could look out and say, after all those times, I worked the steps, but I didn't work the steps, you know? Mm. Not like I understand them now.
Yeah.
You know, so I never understood the feeling I have today. I've never felt like this in my life. Just enjoying moving forward and enjoying just growing, You know, when you talked about the 11th step is seeking, as that's what I'm enjoying, is the seeking.
The whole, for me, the whole purpose, you know, is to find a power greater than myself. When I have all this stuff, character defects, shortcomings, whatever you want to call it, fear, you know, all that stuff that's in there, God can't exist when there's all that stuff in me.
That's the biggest thing that steps out. It's like just, I came to believe something greater than myself. And I didn't really get that until all this ugliness started to go away. And this, you know, and it was, you know, having a gun in my mouth that day, you know, type of thing. That was the, but I didn't understand. And you touched on it earlier. I didn't really understand how to put God in my life. You know, I didn't even understand what that meant other than being Roman Catholic and, you know, not, you know, Sunday school. And that didn't even jive for me anyway, you know, a higher calm. And I use that word because that's what it is it's created such a calmness in my life.
Yeah. And I get returned to sanity. In other words, when the thought of a drink comes by or I get triggered, I see something, I'm capable of thinking the drink through. Oh, I don't think that's going to be a good idea. Whereas before, you know, thought of a drink came by and it's just like natural, you know, just pick it up and go. Never thought about the consequences or anything like that.
No, that's great clarity for my thought process. It's on not understanding sanity, but yeah.
That's, keep it in the context of my alcoholism, you know, because baseline is always the first drink.
Yeah.
You know, if I pick up that first drink, there goes God. And here comes a whole lot of crap.
Oh, Lord. Yeah.
I see it in other people. Man, they hate themselves for what they've done. Trying to get that, renew that relationship to God that they had before. They can't do it. In some ways, they try to do what they did before, and it doesn't work because now they're different. You know, their disease has progressed. Mm. So that's why Bill says we have to redouble our efforts. And we have to really get after it. If we pick up a drink again, we really have to get after it. It's not going to be simple. You know, same old thing. First time's a gift. Second time, I have to work for it.
Right.
You would know.
Yeah.
And I don't want to know.
Right. Yes. Well, Norm, I appreciate you taking time and talking. I'm glad we got to know each other.
Listen, guys, the Lose Control Podcast, A Paradox for Positive, Peaceful Living. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Podbean, Podchaser. Please follow us, share. It's a beautiful thing.
Thanks for joining us. The Lose Control Podcast is committed to you becoming part of a healthy tribe, and we will transform our lives together.